Welcome to the Wang Bennett's Podcast, celebrating West Virginia people, places, and the culture of Southern Appalachia. Now, here's your host, Wang Bennett.
Welcome to Wang Bennett's Podcast. I'm your host, Wayne Bennett. This is episode 120, and it's November the 21st, 2023, 2 days before Thanksgiving. And, you know, college sports is a big business, and it requires some top-notch administration, and sometimes the decisions are not popular. Our guest today is a senior associate athletic director of compliance at Louisiana University at Monroe. And an old Piney View boy, David Boogreed, welcome.
Thanks for having me. I'm glad to be here.
And, you know, every time I hear the Louisiana word, I keep thinking about Jerry Reed's song, Amos Moses. I'm not sure you're familiar with that or not, but he's talking about living in the swamps and the birds and the alligators. Now, you live in northeastern Louisiana?
Yes. It's north central Louisiana. It's actually, I think, closer to Dallas than it is New Orleans.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Are there alligators and swamps?
You know, I didn't know this until I moved there, but apparently there's 3 alligators to every 1 in Florida. And that's scary because you see them everywhere in Florida. And so I have not seen any alligators yet, but I live right on the bayou, so I'm sure I will eventually. But it's, you know, Louisiana is really nice. It's a slower pace of life, and the mosquitoes have drill bits, and so you can't really hang out in the afternoons or evenings. But it's a nice place, really great place.
And how'd you get the nickname Boog?
Funny story. I didn't know my name was David until the week leading up to going to kindergarten. And my grandmother, my dad and I have the same birthday and the same name. And my grandmother, when she saw me in the hospital, I was kicking my feet in rhythm. And she's like, look, he's dancing boogie, boogie, boogie. And it stuck. And my whole life, most people from Piney View call me Boogie Reed. And then when I got to junior high school, my friends cut it down to Boog. And, you know, if I ever lived here full time, I'd just go by Boog in the phone book because no one would know that they would think my dad's David, you know. So,
is your dad and mom still around?
My mom passed away 6 years ago to cancer, but my dad's still here. He owns Bypass Auto Sales over there across from the Armory, and he's still trucking along.
Who introduced you to sports when you were young?
My uncle Randy Lilly and my other uncle Danny Lilly were when I was 2 or 3 years old. They were big time Beckley athletes, and I tell people all the time, Beckley football has been in my life since I was 2, 3 years old because of my uncles, and I was so proud of them when I was a kid and looked up to them. And then they really pushed me in sports growing up. And, you know, Randy got me involved with wrestling. That's how I know John, your son, so well, is we were on the same wrestling team early. And then I got my leg broke in 3 places when I was 8 by Scott West. And that kind of ended my passion for wrestling. And I went from a running back candidate at Boeing Edition to a lineman candidate with all the weight I gained from that leg break, and it's never funny, looked back.
It's funny you mentioned Scott West. He was just here last night. He stopped by to see me. But you mentioned Randy. When I was coaching at Woodrow, Randy came back from Fairmont State, and he started coming over and helping us with wrestling. And he was in good shape, young guy, and it was a lot of help. And then when I left Woodrow, I went to the Y, and Randy came around. I talked him into coaching for Central Beckley in wrestling, and got him into refereeing also. And he did that for a while. And You know, I left a while, went to park. Here came Randy. He was in between jobs or something. Mm. He helped me and helped me for several years. His one of the shifts he was on made it him available to help. And he, so I don't have anything but good things to say about Randy. He was very knowledgeable, good with the kids, and he doesn't come around anymore because he's afraid I'll put him to work.
Yeah, he's enjoying retirement. They were both, you know, out in Piney View. My mom's the oldest of seven, and she was the ringleader of all those siblings. All her brothers were scared to death of her, and she ruled the roost. And I've always been very proud to be, you know, half Lily because of Danny and Randy and my other family out there.
You played football at Woodrow under Pete Colasurto, and you were a year behind my son, John, I think. And,
yes.
That was with that group, Chris Gross.
Yeah, Chris is a year younger than me. He's 91, I'm 90, John's 89, but we are all on the same team, John's senior year. Yeah.
And your senior year, you were all Coalfield Conference, and you were honorable mention All-State. You guys had a pretty good team, 6-4, I think, your senior year, and lost a couple of games, just 7 points or something. It was,
you know, when I was coaching for Beckley, and Coach Colasurto and I were talking once, and he said to me that at that point, this was the mid 90s, probably 96, and he told me at that point, my senior team is one of his greatest disappointments, one of his most underachieving teams, because we had 11 guys sign scholarships on signing day. And I signed with West Liberty, Magic Staples signed with State. And then 8 or 9 of those guys, Kevin Richardson, Lorenzo Thompson, Sean Anderson, Odie Parker, they all signed with Concord. And, you know, and then later Gross and Fred Hill played college football. Matt Blankenship was a junior on that team. He went to Glenville, had a cup of coffee there, and we had a lot of talent. And it just my looking back on it, I blame we should have been playing more as sophomores. We used to beat the seniors in running. You know, at Beckley, it's called Running Raiders. The Raiders are the scout team. Mm-hmm. And we used to frequently beat the seniors, and with all due respect to those guys, but they just, we were much better. Like we cut through JV season like warm butter, you know, and a lot of sophomores lettered that year, but we just didn't know how to win, you know? And I think that's what got us in those tight games. And, you know, and I tell people all the time, there's three people, had they played our senior year, would have switched the whole trajectory of the team, and that's Chris Daniels, because we desperately needed a backup quarterback, and Sean Anderson got hurt late in the season, and Chris Daniels would have carried us through. And then Troy Stifler, and because we could have used his size, and then Teddy Anderson. Mm-hmm. You know, if Ted would have been a receiver / DB for us, and we would have been so much better with those guys.
Now, you played in junior high for Malvern Ross, didn't you?
Correct. And, so very proud of that. I played on the very last Stratton team that he coached when I was in seventh grade. Really? And it's funny, my dad, my whole life, pushed, like he would always say, when you get to Beckley, you'll play for Colasurto. When you get to Stratton, you'll play for Ross. And so I held, and I still hold Coach Colasurto. Coach Ross has left us, but I hold both of those men so high on such a pedestal because of the way I was preached at the whole time I was in midget league. And I didn't have a chance, you know, John and I played midget league together for bowling edition, but I didn't have a choice to play my last year of midget league because my dad's like, you're playing for Stratton in seventh grade. We're not fooling around with, you know, midget league anymore, you know? And my buddies that stayed on that last bowling edition team, they regretted not playing for Ross because by the time eighth grade came around, like it was a whole different ball game in Stratton. You know, the thing about Stratton I like to say is we didn't win enough there when I was in junior high, but when I was a senior, 8 of the starters were Stratton Junior High. And
well, I was going to tell you, in the youth, did you play for Tom Jarrett?
Yeah,
he passed away just a couple months ago.
Yeah.
And he was John's first coach, and then Sarge Maynard and Lyle Richmond, I think, coached it. But the Melvin, I had the privilege to coach against Melvin for several years. And the one thing about Melvin Ross was he was a competitor. He wouldn't give you nothing, and he wouldn't he didn't want you to give him anything. And we've had some. I mean, he coached track, and he even coached wrestling some for a while. And some of our toughest games, even a couple years that we were undefeated, Stratton was our toughest game. We one year, I think, when John and them were in a ninth grade, we were undefeated. I think we beat Stratton 7-6 or 8-6, just when you guys had Tommy Moore and everything.
Oh, yeah.
Our big rivalry was Beckley Junior High because we played them the first game of the season, and they practiced with us. And so we had that rivalry. And, of course, we always wanted to beat Bluefield, but – Stratton, about the sixth or seventh game, would give us fits.
Yeah. You know, I learned a lot about Bluefield and Graham football through Stratton because they beat us, Bluefield beat us like a drum, seventh, eighth, and ninth grade. And then we turn around in high school and we beat them like a drum. When I was leaving the field, either my junior or senior year, I recognized the guy that I'd gone against for 5 years, you know, and I'm like, where are all these werewolves you guys had? You know, where are all those studs? And he's, oh, they're at Graham. They're like 2-time state champion. And those kids had the choice to go across the border and go into Graham. And, you know, they had a dynasty there in the late 80s and early 90s. And it made total sense then. I was like, now it makes sense. Like,
well, yeah. we usually played them the third game of the season, and it was always a Donnybrook. It was knock down, drag out, and I mean some of the best teams that we had. We it was tough. And first time I remember playing down there, they come running out of the dressing room, and I think they dressed 100 people.
If one, yeah,
my guys ran all. You know? When you graduated. Did you go into the Marine Corps or you were?
Yeah. Well, here's the story. I signed with West Liberty reluctantly. I wanted to go to Fairmont like Randy and be closer to Morgantown, which a lot of my buddies that had not gone to the service were at WVU. And my dad just, he and I just went round and round about it. And I ended up signing with West Liberty and, his theory was it's in the middle of nowhere. It's 5-1 girl guy ratio. You can't go wrong at a school like this. And he just loved the coaches. And I got there and absolutely hated it and joined the Marine, came home at semester and joined the Marines. And when I was in the Marines, just decided to go back to college and switched my contract up to reserves. And I enrolled at Marshall and really didn't have any guidance in life, you know, just I was in fraternity and playing intramurals, didn't really want to play football anymore. And that's one of my biggest regrets is if I would have just walked on those Marshall teams, you know, because Gross was on those teams and would always tell me, you're as good as some of these guys at linebacker and defensive end, you should walk on. But I ended up not doing it, but I would have had a 2 hands full of rings, you know, and those were some great Marshall teams. But just kind of spun my wheels, never really found what I wanted to do until I had a friend whose dad coached in the NFL, and I went and stayed with them one weekend, and it kind of changed my life forever. It was the Detroit Lions, and I drove up there. He was a defensive coach. His name was Lamar Leachman, and he had came up through the Giants organization with Parcells and Ray Perkins, and then when Wayne Fonts was hired with the Detroit Lions, he went over with him. And anyways, long story long, I spent the whole weekend with him, and he's the one that put me on the, you need to go be a coach, follow your passion. Don't let somebody tell you you want to be an accountant and a safety advisor or a psychologist. You need to be working in sports, and changed my life forever. And I immediately came home, got certified to coach, moved home to Beckley, went and saw Coach Coliserto, and, you know, asked if I could get involved. And when I was coaching at Beckley, I worked every summer camp that anybody that would hire me at any level all summer long, making contacts. And lo and behold, when I decided to get out of coaching and go into NCAA compliance, they remembered me at the University of Pittsburgh from working their camps 5 years earlier.
Really?
And that's how I got my first big job in athletics, was because I worked those camps when I was fledgling college student here in Beckley. So I always tell kids when I'm speaking to classes in sport management is, you never know who your next boss is, and you never know who the next opportunity is. So always make a good impression and work hard, because it's going to be hard to make it. But once you start making connections, it really changes things.
I worked a summer camp in Pennsylvania in wrestling 1 year, and I roomed with one of the instructors, and it ended up, while we were up there, he gets an Oklahoma State head wrestling job. And then that same summer, he was named the Olympic coach, Jose. Wow. Yeah. And I thought, I'm sleeping beside the guy.
Yeah.
You just never know what's going to happen. But now, how long were you at Pittsburgh?
I was there almost 3 years. I coached at Beckley 96, 7, and 8. And then I went to graduate school at Marshall. And I was a compliance GA there for a year. And then I went to the University of Cincinnati and Xavier for internships. And Marshall hired me back full-time around December of 99. And then I was there until January of 01. And I was at Pitt from January 01 until August of 03. And then Marshall brought me back for a third time as associate athletic director. And then I was there up until April of 07 when I went to the University of Miami. And then I was at Miami from April of 07 until December of 12. And then I was at the University of Kansas until August of 23. And then I took this opportunity at Louisiana Monroe in September 1st of 2023.
Now, when you were at Miami, you got a law degree, didn't you?
I got a late in life law degree. It's a law degree for non-lawyers, but I actually got it when I was at the University of Kansas, and I don't practice. I'm not an attorney, but I have the training, which is for what I do in athletics and what I plan to do in athletics. That's all I really need. You know, law school's real law school is far more intense and a lot more, I have about a third of what you're supposed to get in a JD. So they hit the high notes in the non-practicing law degrees. So,
yeah. Oh, okay.
But I'm very proud of it. I, you know, for a kid that grew up in Piney View, and, you know, Fred Smith, our guidance counselor at Woodrow, told me to just join the Army because I wasn't going to make it in college. And, I'm sitting here with 6 degrees. I want to see him at the mall or on the sidewalk and let him know that I was the one he missed on, you know.
I can believe Fred would say that.
Yeah. Oh, it was very sarcastic. You're like, Reed, you just need to join the Army, son.
What does associate athletic director in the compliance do? I mean, what?
There's a couple of, I'll use some words close to, that I use in interviews is, you're an advocate, not an adversary, but it is a highly potential adversarial role. It's like being an assistant principal. I'm responsible for the actions of every employee, every student athlete, and every booster at the institution, which I,
wow.
So it's sort of like running into hell with a squirt gun. And it's
so they don't assign you just one sport.
No. Well, I oversee the whole area. My staff at Monroe is far smaller than my Kansas staff was 11 people and 7 full-time, and then interns and graduate assistants. And almost all of them were attorneys, and my Miami staff was fairly large, four full time with three attorneys, and which is why I went back and got the law degree that I have, is just to keep up with my staff, kind of thing. But a day in the life is you're constantly, see, I answer to Indianapolis, the NCAA headquarters. So I'm the conduit between those two groups of our staff, our coaches, student athletes, and the rules as they're being made. And nowadays it's gotten very hard, because when I first started in compliance 27 years ago, there were three rules: football rules, basketball rules, and everybody else rules. Now it's far different. And every sport has their own rules, their own recruiting calendars. You have to be a robot to remember it all. And I have to save things on my phone. And the thing that people get enamored with in athletics is the level you're at, right? So like at Kansas, you know, people just assume you're one of the best, whatever. The best compliance people in the country are the smaller schools at your Marshall, Toledo's of the world, because they're applying the rules every day. I was in board meetings 6 hours a day at Kansas for 11 years. I wasn't applying the rules, my staff was, you know? So it's just like that CEO mentality. In the Power Five, you're more of a CEO. In the mid-majors, like at Marshall, you're in the trenches. And here at Louisiana Monroe, it's been invigorating for me to really apply the rules that I've, you know, and all the knowledge and experience I've acquired over, you know, more almost three decades now. But it's invigorating to be at this level again, because I came up through Marshall and I knew what I was getting myself into. And I feel like people that have never been down to the mid-majors don't know how to deal with it. It's sort of like a kid that goes straight to the major leagues in baseball. They don't know what it's like to be on the bus for the Durham Bulls, or, you know what I mean? Or the Charleston Lugnuts or whatever. It's just a different world. And I'm finding it very invigorating to just reapply the rules and get myself caught up mentally, you know, and all those things. With the rules are always changing. And where I have so much experience, I'm able to put out a lot of fires at Monroe without the drama that it requires at another level. You know, the coaches aren't as demanding and egotistical, or, you know, one of my bosses told me once that something happens to a man when he starts making seven figures, and he grows horns and his hair turns purple and his eyes turn green and he starts spouting flames. And it's very true in athletics. I've seen money change a lot of people, you know, for the bad. Once those kids that get drafted and become millionaires, and then administrators and coaches that get elevated into a role, and they change. And sometimes they have to change. You can't be one of the guys when you're the leader, you know. And the one thing I remember people telling me when I was president of my fraternity is, if everybody likes you, you're not doing your job.
Because that's true.
You're going to upset somebody, you know.
Now, you, with all the moving around, how does it affect your family? I mean, of course, you were at Kansas 11 years.
Yeah.
But I mean,
well, it's Bob Markham, the old AD at Marshall, always said this: is you wear out a lot of furniture and you make a lot of acquaintances. You don't make a lot of friends, you know. My first wife, she got to a point where she had had enough of the moving, because she, at one point, we had had four state driver's licenses in 3 years.
Wow.
And just because of the moves we were making. And my current wife is my high school and college girlfriend, and she kind of just goes with the flow, and she's a team player and a new adventure. And, you know, and we look at this opportunity at Monroe, it's going to be a 2-year investment at most, and then we'll be on the move again. And athletics is like the military, it's installations, you know, and you do a 4-year stretch, you do a 2-year stretch, and in my case, both at Miami and Kansas, I stayed too long. Like I turned down Ole Miss and SMU 2 weeks before the Nevin Shapiro scandal hit University of Miami.
Wow.
And I could have been in Oxford, Mississippi with my boots kicked up talking about my poor friends in Coral Gables instead of going through all of that heat with the NCAA. And you know, and I had a ton of chances to leave Kansas before the Adidas scandal. And I just, for whatever reason, I didn't pull the trigger. And then I had to deal with that mess for 5-6 years. And it takes a toll on you. You know, I look at it like this, Wayne, is I'm cheating fate because I was supposed to be in a coal mines this morning. You know what I mean? So both of my grandfathers were crippled in the coal mines. Both of my great-grandfathers were crippled in the coal mines. And my dad was permanently medicaled out of the coal mines. So every day that I'm walking a sidewalk not employed by a coal company is I have cheated fate, and I'm glad, you know. When I get frustrated or upset, it reminds me of you grew up on a dirt road in Beckley, West Virginia. Like you've been so fortunate, you know, just hunker down. And one of my good friends that I went to the Marines with, a guy named Craig Meadows.
Oh, Craig. Yeah. You went in the Marines with him.
Yes, we went in the Marines together. And one time he was working undercover for Beckley PD, and we were talking because we were, you know, we always talk football on the weekends, and I was complaining about my job, and he was like, "Book, I risk my life every day for less than $20 an hour. You kick your feet up and debate sports for 10 hours a day, and you're complaining about it." And it just put me right back where I needed to be. Like, yeah, you're right. I don't have problems. You got problems, you know.
Now, you knew you moved to Monroe just recently, and Louisiana at Monroe, there's been a few famous people. Tim McGraw, I think, went there, the singer. They've had some athletes. Bubby Brister used to play for Pittsburgh. Stan Humphries yep. played with San Diego, I think. There was, I think, one of the Robertsons on Duck Dynasty was went there.
So Willie, yeah.
The Warhawks. What in the world is a Warhawk?
You know, they're named after the World War II fighter plane. Okay. When they had to politically correct themselves with their first mascot, they were the Fighting Indians. And so when they made that change, they went to the Warhawk, which was those fighter planes from World War II. And that's, there's still an Indian or undertone to what they do, but it's not, you know, it's not.
I thought it was a bird at first, but it does deal with flying. But you're in the Sun Belt
Correct.
Conference, and Terry Bowden is your football yep. coach.
Very special. Like the one thing people need to know about Terry Bowden is you won't talk to him more than 30 seconds and not find out that he is a very proud West by God Virginian. And he is so proud of his lineage and his family and who they are and where they're from. And he will not hesitate to quote West Virginia stuff. And it's funny. It's very endearing for me being down there. I was in a meeting the other day with our football staff, and I asked this kid a question, and we were talking about Appalachian State, and I'm like, when did Appy State start calling themselves App State? And the kid looks at me and goes, "Sir, you and Coach Bowden are the only two people I've ever heard call it Appy State." And I just got a chuckle out of it because I was like, well, it must be a West Virginia thing then, because.
Let me tell you a funny story with Terry Bowden. He wrestled also in high school, mm-hmm. and he wrestled for Morgantown. And when he was a junior in high school, he, 145 pounds class, went to the state tournament, qualified, and he got beat. First match, he got beat by a guy from Big Creek named Steve Payne. And there was actually two Payne brothers that were pretty good wrestlers, actually pretty really good at wrestlers. And so the next year, he comes back to the state tournament, Terry Bowden does, and he's undefeated. He's 19-0. I mean, he had two ties. And back then, in a dual match or something, if you tied, they didn't have overtime. But in tournaments, they did. But he was undefeated. And First match, he wrestled Steve Payne. He lost. Okay, put him in the loser's bracket. He comes all the way back through the loser's bracket, gets going for third. Steve Payne, he loses. Three matches in the state tournament in 2 years, he lost to the same guy.
Oh, man. Oh, man.
Tell him when you see him. Steve Payne was asking
Steve
about
Payne.
It.
I will for sure. He's a great person, and he just has such a glow about him. You know, I really like working with him.
Well, he knows football. There's no doubt. Yeah. But, man, you guys got a tough schedule.
Yeah. You know, when you're at this level, you got to play some money games. And nowadays, I think Auburn paid New Mexico State almost $2 million
and
to
lost.
Go down there and beat them. Yeah. But I mean, you know, the SEC schools, you can command a certain rate different than Big 12 and ACC schools. And you know, with these small universities in the Sun Belt, that every penny counts. So it's, you know, the haves and have nots in athletics are very real, and people don't understand sometimes the separation of Concord to Marshall, Marshall to WU, and Ohio State to WU, you know, and there's a separation. And, and especially you get down there in Texas with those schools, you know, some of those small Texas schools are better funded than a lot of major programs in Power Five conferences, just because of the oil money and the way their endowments work. So it's changed a lot in the last 2-3 decades with the arms race, and it's only going to get worse now with.
Well, that's one of the things I wanted to talk about. What's the most broken rule? I mean, what's the one rule that just drives you crazy right now?
Well, I'll tell you, the one that's most blatantly violated is the tobacco rule, where coaches aren't supposed to dip during practice or competition, you know, and 3 out of every 5 football coaches you see on national TV, you know, always have a big chew in. And, the way I handle that is this: is I walk into the football and baseball staff meetings in August every year, and I go, this is the rule. If you want to get lip cancer, go have at it. I'm not going to be tackling people trying to put a dip in. But if you get caught putting tobacco in your mouth during practice or competition on TV, you will be cited for it. And I leave it at that. And, you know, there's just a lot of people do a lot of stupid things. And, like, you know, compliance, the one thing compliance people trip up over themselves is they start letting their personal views and opinions dictate their answer. And when you do that, you've lost, because you have to let go of your personal opinions. And I'll give you an example. At LSU, there was this really young hotshot compliance guy who pulled a kid off the field because of the sock logo of what he was wearing on game day. Now, this is a rule that maybe one person would catch every 30 games, right? But this guy just made it he was going to die on this hill over the logos of the socks. Wow. And he wasn't employed at LSU that following Tuesday. So, you know, it's just people, like if the thing I witness more than anything is, like, if a person played college football, they think their way of thinking and football rules is gold, you know, and I kind of took the opposite. I had great mentoring starting out, and I let the rules and the interpretations dictate my answer regardless of what I thought, you know, and it served me well through the years, because I've, you know, like I said, I could put a school bus full of people that died on a hill over stupid stuff, you know. And compliance is about managing the personalities. You know, a lot of experts out there think, well, they got to have a law degree, they got to have this, they got to have this, they got to have a coaching background, they had to have played. What you really have to have is people skills and the ability to communicate, the ability to be confident, and the ability to not be a nervous Nelly and, you know, trip over your words and be uncomfortable conveying information, because you do have a lot of hard conversations. I'm constantly dealing with upset parents over playing time, or, you know, daddy's princess was talked rough to at practice today, or something legitimate that, you know, someone on our staff foolishly did that we need to look into now because they crossed the line. And helicopter parents make every job hard in athletics now. You know, a lot of people are getting out of little league coaching because of parents. People are getting out of umpiring or being a referee because of the parents. And, you know, everyone is living through their kid. And, you know, I'm guilty of it too. My kid plays travel softball and I'm sitting in the stands, and I've been an athletic administrator and coach for over 30 years. And I'm finding myself getting mad that my kid's getting yanked in the seventh inning for the kid behind her or whatever, because we're paying all this money for, you know, softball. But I'm lucky enough that my wife keeps me recalibrated on, hey, you literally just said this 2 days ago, you know.
I coached three different sports for a period of time, football, wrestling, and track. The first sport I gave up was track because I just needed time. And I love track. You know, I really enjoyed coaching it. But I was a referee for 28 years, and I also umpired a little bit of baseball here and there. But it doesn't seem like to me the parents have changed. I mean, they, you know, you've always had those. You may have more now. I don't know. But you've always had the critics and even, I mean, a coach, you got a guy like Neil Brown at WVU who's winning ball games, and there's people out there that want him fired.
Just to talk about Neil Brown, like the thing about him that I appreciate that a lot of people don't know about him is he has a commitment to West Virginia. If there's a high school kid in West Virginia that can play there, he's going to get them. And I don't think some of his predecessors necessarily felt that way, you know. And what he does with high school coaches in West Virginia, no one's ever done here. And like, go ask Street Surratt, go ask the head coach at Cabell Midland, go ask the head coach at Spring Valley. How many times has a WVU head coach been to your office?
Look at the number of linemen.
Yeah, but you know, and with Spring Valley and Huntington High, with good reason, he better be there, right? But Beckley, you know, Beckley's been a little down for a long time now, and they're getting better the last couple of seasons, but they haven't had a Ligursky roll through there in a while. But Neil Brown's still been to that office. And I don't know if Coach Closerto could tell you Nealon ever walked into that office. And I'm certain Holgerson didn't. Rich Rod may have.
I'm sure.
Yeah.
Now, let's talk about the Neil program. What is that?
Name, image, likeness.
Is that a huge problem?
It's a huge problem. It's systemic cheating in some leagues. And, you know, this is what people don't understand about name, image, and likeness. Is a couple of years ago, the government legislated out that you cannot deduct your donation to an athletic department, right? So all these big boosters that are given hundreds of thousands of dollars, they can no longer write that off, right? Collectives that every university has now for their athletic programs, those are 501(c)s, and every penny you donate to those can be written off. So you're going to start seeing less buildings built and more players bought because of those collectives. And what it's going to, you know, they're already talking about the quarterback at Georgia may stay another year because they're going to guarantee him so many million to stay versus take his chances out in the NFL draft. I don't have a problem with that stuff. What I have a problem is kids on a visit saying it's going to cost $100,000 for me to visit. It's going to cost $25,000 for me to visit. All the collectives are set up differently. And the concern I have and the concern that everyone needs to have is that if you have, like with them talking about making student athletes employees and changing the structure, the amateur structure of college athletics, someone's going to suffer. And that someone is going to be, the second we turn these student athletes into employees, Title IX is gone. So we're not going to sponsor rowing. We're not going to sponsor
softball. That's the one thing
I tell people all the time. I was at a same softball tournament where I'm getting frustrated with my daughter's playing time. I'm sitting with two guys that played in the major leagues that are retired in South Florida, another guy that played major college football, and they're puffing their chest out. It's about time they finally got paid, this, that, and the other. And one of the dads looked at me and said, well, what do you think? And I'm like, well, I hope none of you want your granddaughters to be athletes because they're going to be playing intramurals. They're not going to have the opportunities our sons have because of the way it's going to structure. And like right now, the NCAA minimum, I think, is 16 sports you have to sponsor to be Division I. You're going to start seeing a systemic cutback. It's going to be 12, then it's going to be 8. And when it becomes 8 or 6, we're going to be talking about, remember when they used to play soccer in college? Remember when they used to, have field hockey in college sports? You know, it's not going to exist because so much of your money is going to football and basketball. And the lawsuits that have been placed on their behalf against the NCAA, that someone's going to suffer, and it's going to be the non-revenue sports. And it's just a reality that I may not see it because I'm 52, so I've only got 13 summers left in the industry, maybe, if I'm lucky. You know, people that are having children right now need to be worried about it because their kids, when they go to college in 18, 20 years, may not have the same opportunities we have today because name, image, and likeness is going to change the entire industry. And the other part of it is right now, as we speak, there are lawyers trying to build cases against these collectives for female athletes to sue their alma maters. So when the four-time swimming All-American sues the University of Georgia or Kentucky or Vanderbilt because they didn't have the same opportunities as NIL as the starting quarterback or the backup long snapper, you know, and that's the other part. That's there is no, the NCAA and the government, really, we didn't do a good job planning all this stuff out because right now you have backup high-end basketball players and football players making more in name, image, and likeness than perennial All-Americans in wrestling, gymnastics, women's golf, tennis. Now, you know, certain schools have, you know, the gymnast at WU may have made $1 million last year on her NIL, but she's one in 10,000, you know. And just my experience at Kansas, like, you know, a high-end female athlete's getting maybe $3,500. And some of those basketball players are making over $200,000 a year.
You think that the, of course, like a sport like wrestling, there's only like 60 Division I schools that even have wrestling. You know, you don't have, Sunbelt doesn't have it or anything like that. But you think that they'll eventually go to like clubs?
Yeah.
And no scholarships?
It's going to be, you know, similar. A lot of schools, like I have a friend that played club lacrosse at Pitt. And it was just like being a student athlete. They paid for it though. It was like being a walk on. You know, they paid $3,000 or whatever it was a semester to be on the team, and that covered their travel and their meals on the weekends. And they rented a 15-passenger bus, and they had a sponsor from the university, and they did their thing. But wrestling is such a cult; it will die last. You know what I mean? Uh-huh. But they're all going to change into an intramural club team sport other than the revenue-generating sports. And, you know, and wrestling does generate revenue in the Big 12, but I don't know if they do in the, you know.
Yeah, some of the schools, you take Iowa State, Penn State, those guys, you know, they make the money. And, of course, somebody like Penn State, that's why they're on top, I guess. But yeah. I agree. When the NCAA jumped in there, it didn't seem like there was enough guidelines. There's no transparency as far as public, and I'm not sure that you need that, but I'd kind of like to know how much the quarterback's getting that they brought in and set somebody on the bench. I'd kind of like to know exactly what he's making and what the terms are.
Well, here's some things about it is this hasn't happened yet either because NIL's so young, but in about 5 years, you're going to turn on your ESPN on Sunday, and they're going to do an outside the lines on the kid that washed out of the NFL with three different teams and is now set to go to jail for tax evasion because he didn't pay his NIL money when he was 19, 20 years old, and he owes the IRS all this back taxes and stuff. And the first thing that kid's going to do, because his attorneys are going to coach him to do it, is, well, this, the school's never told me, that no one ever educated me, which is not true. Like, we, you know, just, I can only speak for Kansas, but I mean, they have access to tax attorneys. They have access to programming.
Well, you guys have an award winning.
Yeah, no, yeah. Program. Like, we're an exception, not the rule, you know, a little bit, but still, Kansas's collective is nothing what Georgia, you know, and Texas A&M and those guys are. But the collectives are going to start controlling sports. They're going to start dictating who the coach is, and they're going to start dictating what the athletic director does. And then now, because of, you know, the committee that Condoleezza Rice sat on, the kids have agents for their NIL. So all we've done is just created more systemic cheating and empowered the people that, you know, I hate to use the adage twice, but, you know, I've been fighting agents off with a stick of butter and a popsicle in the mouth of hell for 2.5 decades, you know, and to no avail. And
well, now we're got high school kids. Yeah. Now. I mean, LeBron James' son made $6 million his senior year in high school. And I mean, and there, I think there's 19 or 20 states that have okayed that as far as high schools and students. And
but look at what we're doing to these kids. Like, they're going, like, when you're an average player at Ohio State or Georgia, or you name the Power Five school, you're an average player. You have no shot at the NFL. You've made hundreds of thousands of dollars in NIL money. You graduate from college, and 84 Lumber offers you $48,000 a year to be in their management program, or Hertz Rental Car offers you $50,000 a year. And, well, I made more than that when I was a true freshman in NIL. That's just not, it's not reality, you know, and it's not, it, maybe it's convenient because I don't have that type of athletic prowess to make that money. And maybe it's convenient because, you know, I'm part of a system that is perceived to keep that down, but it's just ruining sports. And what it's going to do too is there's going to be a college president that decides what they decided at Chicago State back in the early 1900s is we don't need football.
Yeah. Yeah.
And we don't need to pay this football coach $3 million a year. We don't need to pay our baseball coach $400,000 a year.
Or $70 million not to play coach.
Right. I mean, what kind of world do we live in when at Ohio State right now, there is a surgeon that can take your nose and take your big toe and make it your nose through plastic surgery. There's a professor that can grow corn on top of asphalt, on top of a car hood. And these guys make 1/20th of what Ryan Day makes as the head football coach. You know, it's just gotten completely out of whack. And the money involved has just tainted every facet of everything in major college sports. It's just...
The surprising thing for me, though, is fans are paying for these tickets. I mean, most of the big stadiums are still selling out. I know that just touches the tip of the iceberg, but price of tickets have gone up considerably because it costs a lot to run a program, but people are still paying and fighting over this. You can't get a ticket to Ohio State spring game.
Oh yeah, and if you do, you're paying $10-$20 for it. Yeah, you know, in some ways, I look at it like it's a great way to for your family to have tradition, and I think that's why the way most people justify it is my greatest memories were going to these games with my uncle. Like for me, you know, my greatest memories in life are going to Beckley football games. Like, of all, I tell this story a lot, but the proudest athletic moment I think I ever had, the one that sticks out to me the most, is running out of Flying Eagle Stadium the first time under the lights. Is one of the most life-changing events for me ever. I felt like I was on top of the world. You know, I was at Notre Dame or Michigan, you know, and a story I love to tell is when the last time I was through Marshall, we're on the field at Ohio State, and Doug Ligursky is a true freshman about to run out onto the field at Ohio State. And I'm standing beside him and I go, this is impressive, but it's not Flying Eagle Stadium, is it? And he looked at me and winked. And then he just took off running out onto the field. But it's a joke between us. But it was playing at Beckley is, you know, I get frustrated with people that bash Coach Caliserto and bash Street and really bashed Lily before that. Like, you know, I wish more people felt the way the inner core of Beckley football feels, you know. And
most of those people have never coached anything in their life.
I have a standing rule, and I don't care if I'm in church. I don't care if I'm at a wedding. If you played for Pete Caliserto, you can say whatever you want. But if you didn't play for Pete Caliserto, you better not say a damn word, you know, and you're allowed to have your opinion if you played for him. But I have no tolerance for all these experts that didn't play for him, you know, and I love the man. Like, there's not a day in my life I don't apply something that Dale Stafford, Butch Lambert, or Pete Caliserto didn't instill in me at Beckley football. And sometimes I hear Coach Caliserto's lectures as I'm speaking to some young kid about what they're doing. And it's that old adage, you know, you don't remember who your first manager was at your first job. You don't remember maybe some of your professors in college, but you always remember who your coaches were.
You do.
And the ones that changed your life. And that, to me, you know, they're all three an acquired taste and personality: Stafford, Lambert, and Caliserto.
You've seen, being associated with all these universities, you've seen a lot of football games.
Oh, yeah.
A lot of basketball games.
Oh, yeah.
And what's going to, you say you'd like to hang around for about 13 more years or whatever. What do you ever plan on coming back to West Virginia?
Well, we bought a place here in Beckley for just to have, you know, and Tara's parents are a little bit older than mine. My dad's turning 70 next week, and Tara's dad passed last January, but her mom's still with us, and she's in her early 80s. And we bought a place just to always have. And athletics is so tumultuous. I just like knowing I can come home and, you know, at any given point. But I'm always going to listen to come home. Like, if you know, if and when the Concord AD job opens, Bluefield State, anything at Marshall, anything at WVU, I really don't have a, if it's not Beckley, Huntington, or Morgantown, I don't have a big appetite to move to Buchanan or Glenville or one of those. But I don't leave anything, you know, anything out in the open. Like, I was briefly involved with the AD job at West Virginia Wesleyan this summer and just decided to stay in Division I. But my goal right now, I went to Monroe to hone my skills to be an athletic director. And my goal is to start making runs at athletic director jobs within the next 18 months. And if not, go back to the Power Five in an administrative role similar to what I was in Kansas. I took a step back to take two steps forward, you know, and a lot of people, I kind of resent how ignorant people are about, why would you leave Kansas for Monroe? Monroe's an unpainted canvas of opportunity, you know, and I can do so much more and have so much more influence. At Kansas, it's a machine. it's a corporation, you know, and IBM, they're not interested in a lot of people's, you know, ideas, whatever, Sears and Roebuck, you name the company, whatever. They're not really interested in middle management's thoughts on things, you know. And so a school like Monroe, a school like Marshall, you get to do so much more than just what you're trained to do, that you can grow out of your role. And that's really what I, you know, tried to do.
One last question. Mm-hmm. What kind of music did you listen to when you were growing up?
Well, John would be my witness on this. Big 80s heavy metal guy. I'm probably one of the most diverse music lovers of all time. My uncles, you know, turned me on to Queen and Elton John when they were teenagers in the 70s. And I was a big Kiss fanatic when I was a little kid. But I've always stayed true to 80s hair metal, you know, and the headbanging stuff there in the late 80s, Metallica, Slayer, Pantera.
They're still around.
Oh, yeah. That's the thing. You know, what's funny is Iron Maiden's your age. And like, I went to see Iron Maiden twice in the last 5-7 years. And I'm always taken aback of, and I go with a bunch of my buddies. And every time we go, I'm like, these guys are older than our dads. And they're jumping off of like 10-foot rocks on a stage. And I'm just totally amazed at how these rock stars can stay at it, you know?
Well, when Mick Jagger, when they played for the Super Bowl there a few years ago, he was 70-some years old, and the guy was dancing back and forth, jumping. Oh. I said, my gosh, where'd you get that kind of energy?
No, I know.
Well, listen, Dave, I appreciate you coming by, man. I've enjoyed talking to you, and you're invited back anytime you want to come.
Appreciate it.
We haven't touched on everything, we've kind of hit some of the high notes, but I really appreciate you coming.
Yeah.
And hope you have a nice Thanksgiving. Anybody else out there that'd like to be on our program, you can email me at awbennett50@gmail.com, and we'll get you on here. And remember, until next time, if you're not dead yet, you're not done yet. And God bless you.